Chapter 9. Maynard's announcement of the recording deal came as a surprise to old friends who'd only sporadically received news of his L.A. adventures. Sometimes a long time would pass, but we wrote letters and talked. Kendall instructor Deb Rockman would remember. He would call late at night and we'd be on the phone for a couple of hours. Sometimes we wouldn't even talk. He'd play music and I'd listen. Then the next thing I knew, he was making it big with Tool. But those who knew the full story recognized that his was no overnight success. Everyone in the band had paid their dues in multiple disciplines, Matt Marshall explained. Therein lies part of who Maynard is and what Tool is. They took all their influences and molded the music into something completely unique. By the time they got together, they were just instantaneously better than almost anybody. Maynard may have seen his destiny long before, had he paid closer attention to the cups and wands and empresses the tarot readers had fanned across their tables.
I hadn't realized the readers might have been talking about singing. They had always used the words voice and presentation, and I thought they were talking in a metaphorical sense. I thought pet stores and sets were the stages they were speaking of. I'd never considered that they meant band and music the whole time.
1992 would be a time of beginnings and of letting go. The tedious and ill-paying art dog days were behind him, and little Harpo had lived out his good long zebra finch life. It was time, Maynard knew, to step from the familiar path and open himself to this new course, and, his other birds and iguanas and fish in the safe care of his loftmates, he was free to discover where it might lead. Zoo's marketing strategy had included a professional pressing of the Tool demo and given it a tongue-in-cheek label number, 72826, digits Maynard chose to correspond with the letters S-A-T-A-N on the telephone keypad. Matt and his colleagues had sent cassettes to bands whose style and message complemented Tool's, and by spring they were performing up and down the California coast, opening for the fusion punk Fishbone and heavy metal Corrosion of Conformity in clubs renowned as testing grounds for the most promising of new groups. Tom Morello's band was now ready to perform publicly as well. Rage Against the Machine had followed a track parallel to Tool's all winter long, and its music had become a solid blend of punk and hip-hop, a sonic rant in opposition to corporate greed and government oppression. Opening for Tool was a fitting debut, a continuation of the creative alliance begun months before. The riffs they'd explored had at last found their proper places in Rage's Killing in the Name and Tool's Part of Me, and their pairing on Jabberjaw's stage only strengthened Maynard and Tom's faith in the other's talents. There was a healthy competition between the two bands, Morello said. We really sharpened each other's knives early on. Just as Lou Malia had imagined, Tool's shows created the hoped-for groundswell of interest. Audiences were captivated by Maynard's hunched creep to the edge of the stage, his curious mullhawk, his penetrating gaze, his confrontational delivery. Early reviewers were at a loss when it came to categorizing the band's music, calling it everything from grunge to metal to alt. But the audience didn't trouble itself with labels. Tool's was music that mattered, whatever its genre. After more than a decade of conservative politics, conformity, and complacency in the face of oppressive dogma, they were primed for change, and they found their anthems of rebellion in the countercultural songs of Smashing Pumpkins and Dumpster, Dead White and Blue, and Tool, whose harmonic complexities and multidimensional lyrics set it apart from the rest.
Our songs were telling people to wake up, stop living in hypocrisy, be true to themselves. But the message had to be tempered. There's an element of humor in all the songs. A friend might say something really funny, and we'd include a verse on what they'd said. Satire helps push through heartfelt emotions and serious issues. That's how you punch the big ideas through.
Ever since he'd special ordered from Sounds Good, the Pretenders' 1981 extended play album, Maynard had understood the power of the EP. The reverse, Chewbone pickup, the tease to whet audience appetite for high-ticket albums and concerts. Recorded at Sound City and released in March 1992, Tool's EP, Opiate, would bring to the band widespread attention, he was sure. Better yet, touring with a nationally known act would be the first step in building a coast-to-coast fan base. If ever a group complemented Tool's raw sound and message of nonconformity, it was Rollins' band. Its End of Silence tour had begun that spring, and thanks to Zoo's efforts, its opening band would be an ideal match. Selections from Opiate would provide a fitting counterpart to the themes of integrity and self-reflection, Tool's sound a perfect pairing with Henry Rollins's forceful anger and the fury of Andrew Weiss's bass and Sim Kane's percussion. 3 months on the road with Rollins' band would give Maynard the chance to observe in action the man whose musicianship and work ethic he'd long admired, and to learn from seasoned musicians the ins and outs of touring. "Andrew Weiss gave me great advice," Maynard would recall. "He helped me understand that the working man is what makes this shit happen. He told me, 'We're just these rock dudes who show up late and leave early, but it's the crew who really gets things done. Treat them well. Respect the guys who actually do the work." Their Atlanta stop included a rare evening of freedom before their gig at the Cotton Club. After investigating the many bars along Peachtree Street, the band members stepped into the mild springtime evening, and the conversation turned to the dedication necessary to excel amid fierce competition. Maynard shared with Kane his memory of Black Flag's 1986 Grand Rapids show and the lasting influence of its opening band. He couldn't quite recall the group's name, but the energy and passion they'd displayed even before the embarrassingly sparse audience had been a glimpse into a world of professionalism he'd dreamed even then of inhabiting.
"I get uncomfortable when people give me weird accolades, so I had no intention of boring Henry with the story of this thing I'd once witnessed. But I felt comfortable talking to Sim because he loved music so much. I told him about this amazing show I'd seen years ago and how it had just blown me away. My heart was racing after the show, I told him, and it impressed me so much that it basically shaped the way I approached my performance with Tool. I'd learned that night that if you're professional, if you mean it, doesn't matter if there's five people in the audience, if there's 500,000, they'll feel it. That honesty translates." And Sim said, "That was me. That was me and Andrew Weiss and gone. You just described our performance in Grand Rapids."
Maynard soon came to understand the rhythm of the road, the daily routine of packing the Ryder truck, the club parking lots, often the only glimpse of the city he would see. He mastered the fine art of unrolling his futon over the equipment cases in the back of the truck and napping a bouncy nap before the next show. The monotony of the highway was tolerable, he learned, if he took comedian Bill Hicks's advice and embraced the journey. En route to Omaha and Austin and Providence, Hicks's cassettes were in frequent rotation in the tape deck, his satirical monologues an echo of Maynard's impatience with mediocrity and apathy, and belief in redemption.
"Behind all the dark humor, Bill was talking about the same things I'd read in Joseph Campbell. If you look at things, really look, if you lift the veil, you start to recognize that light is love, is infinite, is unconditional. Bill was saying that once you understand the nature of nature, you can let go of difficulties and sign up for the ride, knowing that it's just a ride."
And Maynard grew familiar with the Holiday Inns that replicated themselves across the landscape and the occasional Motel 6 on the outskirts of town. In city after city, he walked from stage doors all alike, crossed yet another parking lot, and watched the last of the clubgoers depart into the night, leaving him at the other side of the low fence, alone in the darkness. Familiar faces along the tour route balanced the anonymity of weeks on the road. Kathy Larson at New York's CBGB, Ramiro at Bogart's in Cincinnati, and Tool's one-off show at the Reptile House in Grand Rapids, DJ Steve Aldrich. Art students and alt-rock aficionados wedged into the club on Division to experience the garage punk of Michigan's own Soiled Betty. Then the headliner took the stage, and the space vibrated in a fury of tempestuous rage in the complex rhythmic force that was Tool. The Reptile House wasn't ever supposed to be a live venue. It was supposed to be a dance bar, Aldrich would explain. The building was all hard surfaces, tile and concrete. Shows normally sounded like crap in there. But when Tool played, it was just like they'd put the CD on. It sounded incredible. Aldrich recognized in the music familiar echoes. Tool's atypical time signatures, its subtle nuances, its hint of Swan's minimalism blended in a mature rendering of the CAD tracks he'd featured on his Clam Bake radio program. And Tool seems to him the fulfillment of the band abandoned for lack of a suitable vocalist, the realization of the sonic space and experimental chords he and Maynard and Chris Ewald had explored years before. As soon as I heard Tool, I thought, this is the final version of what was supposed to happen a long time ago, he said. And in Boston, Lansdowne Street was just as Maynard remembered. Most of the crowd had come to Axis to hear Rollins, but a steadfast half-dozen were there for Maynard, friends from the North End Thanksgiving table, and Kurt, who'd loyally flown from Seattle back to his buddy at the club they'd so often visited together. When Tool took the stage, the crowd responded as if it were the headliner. They filled the dance floor and moved in time to the music, leaned forward and strained to decipher Maynard's every word, and not a few women shouted suggestive invitations from the mosh pit. The very women, perhaps, who'd not long before ignored the advances of a lonely pet store merchandising manager. A lone, manic mosher thrashed convulsively through the pit, hurling himself against the others, oblivious to their angry glares. He was a big dickhead punk, Kurt would recall. It was totally uncool. If he was going to roughhouse during the show, he had to go, but nobody on the staff was noticing. Finally, he ran into me, and I grabbed him and pushed him away as hard as I could. The commotion brought the security crew at last from the shadows, a pair of stern bouncers who reached for Kurt's arm. Despite the spotlights shining into his eyes, despite his concentration on the job at hand, despite his inability to tell one slammer from another in the dark pit, something caught Maynard's glance. Perhaps it was the flash of Kurt's white Tool logo t-shirt. Perhaps it was his blonde hair distinct in the darkness. Perhaps it was synchronicity, or chance, or coincidence, but he looked out into the crowd and saw his friend. Maynard stopped singing. He stepped to the edge of the stage and raised one arm. The guitars fell silent. Danny's drumsticks were still. The crowd was quiet, too, disoriented by the sudden shift in energy. Maynard pointed toward Kurt and spoke, his voice steady, firm. He stays. Then he stepped back, and the music resumed as abruptly as it had ended. Danny and Adam and Paul picked up the beat, and Maynard's cry rose on key. The troublemaker was led to the door, and Kurt joined the crowd as it closed in a swaying semicircle before the stage, the driving rhythms drawing them deeper into the mystery of what this group might be all about. Maynard's 1993 Daytimer showed few breaks in an itinerary that would take the band three times across the Atlantic and to no fewer than 29 cities on the summer's Lollapalooza circuit.
You wake up, and you know you're on the road, but you don't know where you are. It wasn't like I was drunk the night before and woke up and couldn't remember anything. But you had to remind yourself what's happening today and where you were yesterday. There were so many people profiting from our being on the road that half the time you didn't have any control of where you were going or when.
A month in Europe early in the year included stops in Paris and Copenhagen, Zurich and London, in a performance schedule that left no time for sightseeing. Given the minuscule per diem, even cab fare for a quick jaunt from their hotel to a castle or a museum was out of the question. A day off meant an excursion no more exotic than a walk to a nearby pizzeria, where Maynard and his bandmates pooled their kroner and weighed a life on the road against its all but invisible rewards.
I'm hoping that I'm not out here for nothing. You're looking for acceptance in whatever form it might take, whether it's a young German lady smiling at you, or some guy who's excited because the song blew his mind, or an older dude who came to the show with his younger brother. You didn't expect he'd like this music, but somehow resonated with him. You're looking for any sign that you're doing something right. You wanted a room full of people to walk away going, "Holy fuck, yes. That was what I'd hoped it would be."
The release in April of Tool's first full-length album kicked off a 2-month promotional tour up the California coast, where audiences discovered in Undertow a study in contradiction, a balance of heavy metal and soft cadence, a lyrical paradox that not only demanded attention, but invited participation. The album's immediate success was due as much to Zoo's respect for the band's creativity as to its marketing efforts. When you have a band that is so thoroughly evolved, the smartest thing to do is to support it and get out of the way, Matt Marshall explained in a 2014 interview. The best marketing a record company can do is be as invisible as you can and let the artwork and imagery and music speak directly to the fans. To do that full package as well as Tool did right from the beginning is rare. With the release of Undertow came the official Tool biography, an out-of-the-box departure from the standard Just the Facts, Ma'am press kit. The 2-page backstory credited the band's mentors, whose work had impacted their own, including, first and foremost, American lacrimologist Ronald P. Vincent. Tool's ideology was at last explained, to the relief of journalists and music critics struggling to understand the band. Its approach, the document explained, was a musical testament to Vincent's principles, the imperative to fearlessly face both joy and sorrow in order to transform personal pain into healing and enlightenment. Radio stations across the country soon added the audience favorite, Sober, to their programming, and the video was regularly featured on MTV's Headbangers Ball. And word of mouth played its part in bringing the album to the attention of listeners who'd otherwise not have associated Maynard with the latest rock sensation. "A friend of mine told me about the album shortly after it came out," Steele Newman would recall. "He told me about this great guy on vocals, this Maynard Keenan. I'm like, not Maynard James Keenan." Steele remembered Maynard only as the housemate who'd sat quietly on the Pearson Street couch eating Cheerios and was hard-pressed to imagine the man who'd fed fish food to party guests as a frontman. But when he placed the CD in his player, the voice he heard was unmistakable. "I listened to it, and wait a minute, yes, I loved the music, and not just because it was my old roommate singing." Maynard, always insistent on giving credit where credit was due, listed as an inspiration in the liner notes comic Bill Hicks, whose recordings had made bearable the long hours in the Ryder truck the summer before. "We sent him copies of the album," Maynard would recall. "He wrote back and thanked us for the music. I called him and pointed out that we'd mentioned him in the liner notes. He hadn't noticed. He was just thanking us for the CD." The call began a dialogue that, by the time the band returned from Canada in early summer, had turned to the topic of collaboration. "We were both excited about working together on a mixed-media presentation," Maynard would explain. "Maybe he could do a comedic stand-up between Tool sets. Maybe he would open for us, or we'd do half a set and he'd come out and do a bit." But the more they discussed their plan, the less confident they were. Hicks had no trouble captivating a crowd in a comedy club, but as much as his in-your-face material complemented Tool's, holding the attention of keyed-up slammers would be another matter. "We realized a show like that would have to be presented in an unfamiliar forum," Maynard explained. "Given the expectations of a Tool audience, we'd have to take it out of the rock club they're used to so they could appreciate the whole experience. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out how we'd calm down a bunch of skinheads to listen to jokes." Even in the wake of Undertow's success, Zoo Entertainment hadn't forgotten its commitment to Bill Manspeaker. Serial Killer, the 11-song green jello video Manspeaker had begun nearly 2 years before, had wrapped recording at Sound City and was at last ready for distribution. Zoo had sent copies to a handful of outlets, including Seattle rock station The X, KXRX. The Seattle DJ was appalled by serial killer's low artistic quality and high degree of inanity. He said it was the worst degeneration of music that could possibly be happening, Manspeaker remembered. The assessment only confirmed what Manspeaker had said all along, that the history of rock and roll had culminated in the world's worst band and its song about pigs. The DJ queued up the track to demonstrate to his listeners the sort of drivel he received from recording companies, and prefaced the song with an exasperated discourse on the lamentable breakdown of the music industry. Then a curious thing happened. The request lines flashed with calls from Seattle listeners begging for more. More Big Bad Wolf, more machine gun fire, more falsetto chinny chin chin, and Three Little Pigs became the most requested song in Seattle radio memory. When the news reached the Zoo office, they scrambled to press enough CDs to satisfy the sudden demand of record stores and radio stations from California to Maine, whose listeners had learned of the Little Pig phenomenon and insisted they too air the song. All of a sudden, this weird pig song's playing everywhere, Manspeaker said. The next thing I know, we're on MTV. To his amazement, the song rose to number 17 on the Billboard Hot 100 list, and number 5 in the UK. And in May, Three Little Pigs was certified gold by the Recording Industry Association of America. That was Maynard's first hit song, Manspeaker explained. Of all of his incredible songs and all the gold and platinum records, that was his first. The guy that everyone is so serious about, it all started with Not by the Hair of My Chinny Chin Chin. In 1993, American youths had more on their minds than cavorting pigs. L.A. still reeled in the aftermath of the Rodney King incident and the ensuing riots, and tensions were high following American attacks on Iraqi intelligence headquarters and the attempted bombing of New York's World Trade Center. They welcomed a summer of release in the third season of Lollapalooza, the movable feast of music and dance co-founded 2 years before by Tool manager Ted Gardner. All summer long, they descended upon stadiums and fairgrounds and amphitheaters as the festival made its way from Portland to St. Paul to Raleigh and across the South. Thousands strong, they came in search of grunge and alt-rock, of ear-splitting, angry catharsis to reflect their discontent and deflect their anxiety. They crowd-surfed in the mosh pits and visited the ethnic food tents and vendor booths, and despite the heat and overpriced Evian, they dedicated their days to their mission, a surrender to the dark metal of Alice in Chains, the funk twang of Primus, the passionate melodic screeds of Rage Against the Machine, and the discovery of bands on the second stage, groups like Sebado, Royal Trucks, Muta Baruka, and Tool. Tool was low band on the totem pole, and its tour bus only a step above the rider truck. It had kind of a better bed, Maynard would recall, if a coffin is a better bed. At dinner time, he took from the small cooler another can of Coors Light and watched band managers and promoters and accountants share fine Rieslings and Gewürztraminers. Faint guitar riffs and shouts of the crowds drifted over the grounds, and he thought of whole ducks crackling on a grill, goblets of first-growth Bordeaux. But Lollapalooza was the realization of dreams he'd never imagined on those Somerville evenings. An invitation to join Alice in Chains' Lane Staley in a stirring duet of Rooster on the main stage, and best of all, taking the stage following his friend Tom's act. Many a show, Tool would get the better of us, and we were like, we gotta go write some more songs, Morello would recall. It was great. People were getting the shows of their lives. The enthusiastic audience response to Tool allayed any lingering fears Lou Malia might have had about Maynard's appearing in a venue larger than Club Lingerie. The band was killing it, Matt Marshall would recall, so much so that in mid-July, Tool was elevated to a slot on the main stage. The tour was a chance for friends and family along the Lollapalooza route to discover exactly what Maynard had been up to since he'd moved to L.A. "We were surprised," Jan would admit of her day with Mike at Maynard's July performance at Chicago's World Music Theater. "We thought he was just saying he was in a band." When the tour reached its final stop in Irwindale, California, in August, Maynard and Bill Hicks tested their idea of collaboration. Hicks announced the band and then, deadpan serious, told the crowd he'd dropped a contact lens in the mosh pit. Impatient as it was to hear Swamp Song and Flood and Prison Sex, they obediently knelt to search the dusty lawn. Maynard returned to L.A. for a 2-month respite before he must do it all again. And his dream began. The dream of a place welcoming and safe and somehow familiar. The dream that stirred in him a nostalgia for green valleys and canyons and creek beds he'd never seen, of mountains red with sunrise, of the spangle of stars in a sky he'd never known.
"I dreamt that I was flying over a vast desert. I'm flying through the air, and I come over a crest into a valley and hover over a small town on the side of a hill. I turn toward the west, and I see in the distance a huge wave cresting and just completely annihilating this large city on the horizon." About a month later, I got a package from Bill Hicks. He was in the middle of editing his third album, and he sent me a cassette of the music. He had some questions about me, whether the music fit with the comedy or not. It was called Arizona Bay. I thought about my dream, and I had an idea that it had to be Arizona that I saw. I'd spent some time in Phoenix, and the dream didn't look anything like that, but I knew it was definitely Los Angeles getting its ass kicked.
With the new year, Maynard was off again for performances in Atlanta and D.C. and Toronto. "A normal going-home lifestyle? You don't want to let your mind go there," he would recall. "Touring is what life is now." Between gigs, he'd found time to move to the Tudor bungalow in North Hollywood he'd admired when he'd visited Steve Hansgen's sound studio there. When the house became vacant, he was first in line to sign the lease and transported his boxes and his black trunk, the finches, 2 parrots, and a brand new waterbed to the little house where gingerbread cornices curled beneath the eaves, a shade tree overhung the front lawn, and the porch light would be on when he came home. The windowed wall in his bedroom looked out over the gardens and the wide backyard, where squirrels and chipmunks scampered through the ferns, and hummingbirds and kinglets and the occasional raven settled among the purple flowers of the jacaranda tree. Once the touring schedule settled down, he imagined, he'd tend the rosemary and bougainvillea and trim back the ivy that crept up the side of the house. "A Zen garden always includes a water feature, so I built a pond in the backyard and stocked it with koi," he would recall. "I needed to maintain that sense of where I came from. You've got to have some sort of oasis to stay grounded." He'd have no trouble writing there in the productive company of Hotsy Menshot and Pepper Spray Jerry, housemates as committed to their work as he. Hotsy was Gary Helsinger, a Green Jello member and a savvy A&R rep for Chrysalis Music Group. Guitarist by night and businessman by day, Jerry Flippo spent long hours hunched over his desk developing his credibility and his contact list and working to legalize the public sale of pepper spray. A frequent visitor was Tim Cariente, a self-styled entrepreneur whose talent behind the camera was equaled only by his passion for rock and roll. If there was a band to be photographed, Cariente was there with his Nikon, and after shooting Tool's Palladium show in January, he and Maynard had become fast friends. As marketing consultant for Oakley Incorporated, Cariente was ever on the lookout for opportunities to promote its sunglasses and visors and ski apparel, relying on social networking long before his competitors had heard the term.
The word marketing had always left a bad taste in my mouth, but Pepper Spray Jerry and Tim weren't in a stuffy office coming up with clever catchphrases to trick you into buying carcinogens. They were growing their businesses by working with friends. It was my first glimpse into a positive side of marketing. They made it look fun.
Maynard's own work had reached an awkward and worrisome impasse. His opiate and undertow lyrics had come easily. The words and motifs he'd translated from his own anger and frustration and sadness. But his new effort seemed forced and uninspired. Tool's next album should transcend what had come before, he knew. But nearly 2 years on the road could only inspire an industry cliché, the legendary and doomed third album. In the 70s and the 80s, it seemed like the first two records of every band were exciting collections they'd worked all their lives to write, he would explain. Then there was the third record they wrote on a tour bus or in a hotel room. There's no life in it. It's the fucking road album. I didn't want that for us. But the house on Lameda, 6 miles from the commotion of Hollywood Boulevard and the unpredictable comings and goings at the loft, might be his haven, the peaceful setting where he would regain the psychic balance he seemed to have lost. Gold records and hit singles and international acclaim cast about Maynard an aura irresistible to the groupies and aspiring performers who imagined fame by association when they appeared in public at his side. If they weren't the trusted sisters of the long-ago beach days, their adoration and intimacy was, for the time being, satisfying enough.
My biggest concern was to get laid. My priority was to be validated, to be desired. This was my ticket to undo all the dismissive behavior from family and teachers and the army of people who had ignored my potential. It was my chance to have somebody who I didn't even know and who didn't even know me give me everything in a moment without question, just surrendered. I'd never had that. That power was new.
There was no dearth of attractive young admirers eager to share his life and his bed, and he became expert at subterfuge and split-second timing, often returning from a night with one woman seconds ahead of another pulling into his driveway. The women brought to the relationships dysfunctional patterns of their own, coping mechanisms and habits that perfectly dovetailed with his. The borders between their performance personas and their offstage lives were porous, their dramas enacted in suspicion and disparagement and angry outbursts. The criticisms and manipulation were subtle at first, but escalated over the weeks into irrational demands and attempts to control his every coming and going, into slapping and pummeling and windows broken in jealous rage. "I didn't understand this weird abusive dynamic," Maynard would recall. "My parents never hit me when I was a kid, and none of the women I'd known in Michigan or Boston ever acted this way. I was trying to be open to whatever might happen and just embrace whatever came, but much of the time, the relationships went in an ugly direction." He explained and cajoled and struggled his way from one tumultuous amour only to find himself in another just as destructive. More than once, the violence and confusion led him to retaliate with passive-aggressive tactics of his own, abrupt and unexplained breakups, and restraining orders against women he'd once believed he loved. "When I look back, I'm not happy with a lot of my behavior," he would admit. "I was gaining understanding on a lot of levels, but on quite a few more, I was doing things I wasn't proud of. I'm not ashamed, and I don't regret anything, but I felt like I was losing myself to weird desires." So many seemed unaware of such concepts as commitment and fidelity, and Maynard, caught up in the addictive cycle, succumbed to their allure and their attention, however superficial. And then he'd turn, as if just over his shoulder someone might appear to understand his unspoken joke, ask to hear his story, and be there to help rewrite it. On a morning in mid-January, Maynard awoke to find CDs and books spilled across the floor and the pictures on the walls askew. He'd slept through his first California earthquake, the Northridge quake centered in Reseda, only 12 miles away. He found only a broken saucer or two on the kitchen floor, but he soon learned of collapsed apartment complexes and parking garages and whole sections of the Santa Monica Freeway. Reporters called it one of the most powerful urban quakes in U.S. history. Powerful enough to damage Gazzari's on Sunset so irreparably it would be demolished. The old Hastings Hotel would close too, and with it, Raji's. He spent the morning putting his house in order and reflecting on Bill Hicks's cassette and his prescient rant of fault lines and of L.A. slipping complete into the Pacific. Over the winter, Maynard had noticed in Hicks a shift in focus and enthusiasm. "I sensed something was off," Maynard would recall. "I told him we had a short tour coming up in February and that we should talk about him joining us." But Hicks was hesitant to commit to the project he'd embraced only months before. He was like, "Yeah, we'll talk about it," Maynard would remember. Hicks had always answered Maynard's calls on the first ring, but now, without warning or explanation, the calls went unanswered. "Then I had another dream," Maynard recalled. "Bill's girlfriend Colleen and his manager Duncan and a lot of other people were at a motel and everybody was crying. And Bill wasn't there. So I called Duncan and I said, 'Man, I just had the most fucked up dream and I haven't been able to reach Bill. What's going on?'" Hicks, Duncan told him, had only told a few close friends about his diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. The weekly chemo treatments had had little effect, and in January, after a final show at Caroline's on Broadway, he'd moved from New York to his parents' house in Little Rock. "We talked many times after that," Maynard remembered. "He was still hopeful, like, 'Well, maybe if I can beat the unbeatable cancer, we can still do this show.' I felt like he just wanted to talk." And they talked often, Maynard listening patiently as Hicks struggled to articulate his increasingly incoherent thoughts. The calls continued until Valentine's Day, when Hicks, the man of unstoppable wit, the man with still so much to say, so much to teach of consciousness and compassion, could not speak at all. Los Angeles continued to live up to its reputation as a New Age hub, its mediums and seers and self-proclaimed oracles peering into cards and tea leaves and crystals to bring insight and guidance to their anxious customers. Worried for his friend and frustrated by his own creative inertia, Maynard turned to a psychometry practitioner in the Valley, a woman who claimed the gift of reading magnetic energy patterns in metal. Allowing her to see what she could see in a piece of jewelry certainly couldn't hurt, and might offer some new perspective. He'd searched for a suitable object for analysis, and chose at last a silver ring he hadn't worn in years, and with no particular significance. The reader held the ring between her palms and closed her eyes, channeling or meditating, or perhaps only acting. "Then she asked me who Paul was," he remembered. "And she goes, 'Yeah, that's done.'" Her words took Maynard by surprise. This Paul she sensed in the ring's aura might be anybody at all, he reasoned, and surely not Tool's bass player, who seemed as devoted to the group as he'd ever been. But he wrote the name on a slip of paper and asked what his next steps should be. "She goes, 'I don't know, something about London,'" he would remember. He added "London" to the piece of paper and put it in his pocket, no more enlightened than he'd been that morning, but armed with a cryptic map, at least, should he ever need to consult it. In early February, the band's short tour had begun as planned, a 3-week barnstormer up the East Coast and through the Midwest that included an evening at the Orbit Room in Grand Rapids. "I saw Maynard firing up a lot of disenfranchised and disillusioned young people," art instructor Deb Rockman would recall of the sold-out show. "He had to be really loud and scream this stuff to get through to that very angry generation." She'd watched the crowd sway in trance-like attention before the stage, watched them lip-sync his lyrics. "The music was very mature," Rockman said. "It wasn't all about fucking and drinking and partying. Maynard was telling people to look around, to notice what was wrong. That was always his intention." The Grand Rapids stop included a day of freedom before he was due in Detroit for Saturday's show. Maynard walked with Steve Aldrich and Ramiro through the downtown, hearing the latest news of Aldrich's radio program and Ramiro's paintings, and noting the changes to the city since he'd lived there. The amphitheater was empty of skateboarders on the sub-zero afternoon, and they stamped their boots against the cold and darted into the welcome warmth of a coffee shop, where record bins lined the walls and a narrow staircase led to the tattoo parlor downstairs. "And there," Aldrich explained, "we find a Grand Valley art teacher." The man sat alone with his design binders, his graph paper and ink bottles. The instructor, who 6 years before had severely critiqued an assignment Maynard had believed was especially well executed. It was a metal sculpture that Maynard loved, Aldrich would recall. This guy had hated it and just ripped it apart, and now he's departed the university and is working in a basement tattoo shop. The professor looked up from his sketchpad at Maynard's mohawk and faded jeans and asked what he'd been doing since he'd left school. Maynard's response was matter-of-fact, emotionless. "Well, my band and I did a show at the Orbit Room last night for 1,500 people," he explained, extending toward the astonished teacher a copy of the day's Grand Rapids Press. "And here's my picture on the front page of the paper." "You have no idea how happy this made Maynard," Aldrich recalled. With time to spare, his friends delivered Maynard at the stage door of the State Theater, the Beaux-Arts performance space that dominated Detroit's Grand Circus Park. Once more, Tool pulled out all the stops, its energy drawing the crowd to its feet in frenzied appreciation of prison sex and sober and the enigmatic 4 degrees. Exhausted, Maynard went to his hotel afterward and fell into a troubled sleep. "I sat up in my bed not long after midnight, full upright like somebody just punched me," he remembered. "It freaked me out. I'm wide awake in this room going, what the fuck was that?" He went to the window and looked out over the city. Cabs moved slowly through the streets below, and in the distance, the lights of the Ambassador Bridge reflected white against the dark river. All was well, he told himself, and set his alarm to be sure to wake up in time for breakfast with Danny. In the morning, his pager flashed, alerting him of some urgent message left while he'd slept. Perhaps his manager had called with last-minute schedule changes. Maybe Danny had phoned to tell him of the perfect bacon-and-eggs diner he'd found nearby. Maynard dialed his 800 number, and in the gray dawn quiet, listened to Duncan's message. At 11:20 Little Rock time, he reported, Bill had died. Maynard powered through the evening's show in Cleveland, his performance as professional and controlled as any other. The night flight to London would give him plenty of time to sort out his feelings. One thing was sure. He would not mourn.
Bill and I had always talked about how life was just a ride. If you really believe that, then death shouldn't be seen as an awful thing. But at the same time, I don't think he was ready. His career was so right on the edge of exploding. I would imagine most people's tendency would be to get obliterated, but it didn't. My reaction wasn't to get drunk on the plane. My reaction was to get some sleep so when I got where I was going, I could do what I do. I felt like the best way to remember Bill was to keep using my talents.
He lay his forehead against the window and looked down at sea stretching dark in every direction to the horizon. And he slept, the sky brightening as the jet flew toward sunrise. The London show kicked off a summer itinerary as rigorous as that of the year before, with stops in the Netherlands and France, a non-stop blitz across the U.S. and Canada, and a second European tour. In late July, the Shepherd's Bush show opened with UK band Peach, a progressive metal group whose experimental melodies and daring psychedelic style complemented the Tool sound. Maynard was impressed by the inventive whammy work of Peach bassist Justin Chancellor, so much so that he and the others invited him to sit in for Paul on the evening's performance of Sober. Chancellor's growling, low-end interpretation brought an unexpected depth to the song, and if this was all the metal reader had seen in her vision of London and Paul, it was enough. Nearly 5 months of downtime would be just the break Maynard needed to come to terms with Bill's death, to think, or not think at all, to laze away his afternoons, a package of Twizzlers beside him on the waterbed, and a supply of VHS tapes stacked nearby. It might be time to revisit Wings of Desire, or Bliss, but he was curious about the collection of Drunvalo Melchizedek lectures a friend had dropped by some months before. Peculiar as Melchizedek's backstory was, that an otherworldly spirit had stepped into his consciousness to promote ancient esoteric teachings, Maynard was fascinated by his theories. The Egyptian pyramids, Melchizedek maintained, weren't in fact tombs, as anthropologists had long claimed, but initiation chambers where a chosen few had been granted an understanding of sacred geometry. Melchizedek had accepted his mission, he explained, to enlighten 20th century minds of the power of mathematic principles underlying everything from spiraled nautilus shells to the structure of DNA to the arrangement of leaves on a long-stemmed rose, the recurring patterns that give order to the physical world.
A lot of what Melchizedek talked about rang true. Never mind all the "I'm a walking spirit who existed back in Egypt and the gods have taught me geometry." What I took from it was all the things that can be explained by geometry. I went back to what Boots Newkirk tried to teach us about a table with only two legs. Is it going to stand up? No. Three legs? Okay. When you do transit survey, two points don't tell you anything. Your target could be either one. But if a third point, you can calculate center lines and meridians and trajectories to pinpoint the artillery's location and the direction of enemy fire. The geometry of three points makes things stable.
Maynard lay back on the waterbed and thought of the honeycombs his father had kept in a far corner of his garden, their endlessly replicating cells, each the same. Of fugues and cannons, of the spiderweb hanging lace-like and precise in the cornice over the front porch, of the apple he'd sliced at lunchtime, and the way its halves had fallen across his plate to reveal the shape of a star. His reading list that summer branched from novels to folklore to ethnographies, spiraling in an ever-widening study of fact and myth that, no matter the genre, came to the same striking conclusion. There was, it seemed, more than one history of the world. Sober had become a hit single in March, and in September, Undertow was certified gold by the RIAA. I was absolutely aware of having put the dominoes in a row and of making them fall in the way that I had hoped, Maynard would recall. But to take the next creative step and avoid the dread third album, he knew he must take the time to regroup, to revisit the concepts and notions that had first fueled his dreams. "All this touring is eventually going to catch up with you," he would explain. "Now let's do some sit-ups and try to see if we can't maintain an edge. I needed to find a balance in order to bring structure to the art and still make it vulnerable and volatile." He drew his blinds against the August heat and began to sort through the stack of books he'd accumulated during his time on the road. He turned first to his tattered volumes of Joseph Campbell and segued to the John Crowley novel he'd looked forward to reading for months. Egypt, to his delight, was a tale even more fantastical than Little Big. He read of a forgotten age when mathematics and magic, alchemy and astronomy, weren't antithetical but faces of the same reality. Of days when scryers gazed into their glass and communed with the angels they saw there, learning from them their lost language. Accounts of those gone times weren't recorded in history texts, Campbell had written, but they hadn't entirely vanished. Their traces persisted across millennia in the symbols of the tarot, in runestones and hieroglyphs and petroglyphs. They endured in the stories passed down from grandfather to father to son, tales of lead turned to gold, of giants and dwarves once as common as fruit flies, of gods and goddesses come down to live among men. They remained as parables and allegories, stories of transformations and transmutations that defied the laws of modern science. On the other hand, maybe it had all happened just that way. Maybe, as Crowley suggested, the laws themselves had changed. The very axioms that explained time and space and life and death and love. And perhaps another history determined Maynard's own path, a forgotten or deliberately denied story as crucial to his success as Boots Newkirk's lectures or maneuvers on the Fort Sill training ground. If he shifted his gaze, he thought, the details of his hidden tale would come into sharp relief, the way the picture in the Highlights magazine at the dentist's office had changed from an urn to smiling profiles when he'd tilted his head just right. For a long time, Maynard had struggled to make sense of the hazy memories that returned sometimes when he least expected. The hours alone in the farmer's house in Tallmadge, his distant and taciturn stepfather no one dared defy. Perhaps he'd only imagined the furtive glances between the otherwise stern church members when they'd come to the Ravenna house, the sudden silences that even as a small boy he'd known he must never question, the not quite covert touches passed between the adults gathered in the living room on a Saturday evening. The oddly uncomfortable memories might not have been real at all, but fantasies he'd created to cope with Mike's departure, scenarios he'd dreamt to distract himself from Judith's infirmities. But fabrication or fact, his narratives had left their trace, a vague sense of confusion and mistrust, of trespass and violation. His mother would remember more than he was sure. But drawing from her the details was no easy task, and their frequent phone calls that summer left him no more enlightened than before. Judith was blocking things then, Maynard's Aunt Pam would recall. She was trying to forget the painful things that had happened when he was a little boy. His unresolved bitterness and fear had inevitably found their way into his lyrics, but Maynard had for a long time sensed an untold subplot, a backstory that would explain his confusion and anger. It would take gentle prodding to reveal the truths that had gone unspoken for decades, truths that, once he understood them, could only bring a deeper dimension to his art. "Eventually, the whole story came out in conversations with my mother and my aunt," he explained. "It turns out the family included a classic, inappropriate uncle. My mother was raped when she was a little girl. That's what the songs are really about, the cycle of denial and abuse, emotional and physical, that, for all I knew, had been going on for generations."
When you're exposed to that kind of abuse as a young child, you carry it with you, especially when everybody else pretends it never happened. My mother buried the memory of what her uncle had done, and it came out in her own lack of boundaries. She invited people into her home who had questionable boundaries, because that's what she knew. That's what she attracted. Then I grew up seeing that, so I learned no boundaries. Having that moral ambiguity could be the makings of a sociopath, but on the positive side, it could be that I think outside the box, because I was never confined in one. I'd done some inappropriate things that I wasn't even aware were inappropriate. But that lack of conventional boundaries helped me push the envelope in other areas. That's the way I was wired.
The palms that lined La Maida drooped in the heat, and the animals in the garden sought what little relief they could beneath the ferns and the rosemary bushes. When the temperature was at its record-breaking highest, Gary ventured to the market, and by the time he returned, Maynard's mullhawk was no more. "It was so fucking hot," Maynard remembered. "I took scissors and a razor and shaved it all off." The new look offered an unexpected benefit. Shorn, Maynard found he could go about the city incognito and fear no censure should his activities conflict with his public's expectations. As the band had become more and more well-known, fans and followers were quick to recognize on the sidewalk the wiry frontman with the long curls, and Maynard found the attention not only annoying, but limiting.
"I felt like this thing on my head had become some kind of signature, and I needed to get rid of it so I could move about more freely. On the one hand, being part of Tool meant people knew who I was, and that was cool. But the paradox is that that public image ends up stifling you. It slows you down and boxes you in. Back then, there was no Facebook to be throwing pictures at you. So if I could change my look, I could be anonymous and walk around unrecognized. That made it easier to move forward and discover new things.
At the Gingerbread House, he rediscovered pastimes and passions he'd long neglected. He brought out sketch pads and pens and recipes for quiches and chocolate chip cookies, and invited in old friends and new, Tom Morello and Brad Wilk and Moon Unit Zappa, and their camaraderie provided the connection and centering he'd so missed while he'd been on the road. They shared stories and laughter, updates on the role they'd read for that week, and the upcoming gig, Take Out Orange Chicken and Crab Rangoon. "We connected intellectually and heart-wise," Zappa recalled in a 2014 interview. "Maynard was an extremely soulful person. There was such a difference between this mild-mannered Clark Kent type living in that funky little house and his contained electricity punk rock persona. The dichotomy was fascinating." And before they settled in for a screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, or Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, Maynard led his friends to the backyard to greet Butterball, the newest addition to his menagerie. The fat Tom Turkey stomped and charged and fluffed his feathers and jerked his head toward Tom and Brad. His L.A. family grew to include the waitresses at Millie's Cafe, the Silver Lake diner fitted out in campy 1940s Hollywood decor. They greeted him by name when he came in the door and served up his scrambled eggs with spinach and toasted pine nuts and news of the day. "I felt like I'd finally found my groove," he remembered. And Maynard and Danny and Adam and Paul found themselves not so much invited as expected at Lou Malia's over-the-top feasts. "Every holiday I had open house," Malia would explain. "The rule was, the line starts at 2 o'clock, and if you're late, you've got to put your food in the microwave yourself." There was always room for one more at Lou's house, one more musician whose schedule prevented their going home for Thanksgiving, one more songwriter with deadlines that kept them in L.A. at Christmas time. Before the day was over, 200 guests might circle the buffet table to heap their plates with turkey and ham, lasagna and candied yams, asparagus parmesan, and garliced green beans prepared by Lou himself. Maynard and the others stayed as long as politely possible, prolonging their visit with another slice of pie, one more cannoli. Their laughter echoed long into the morning through the big house in the Hollywood Hills, this home where candles burned, and no one need be alone. By midwinter, Maynard's was a familiar face at the city's premier comedy clubs, Beth Lapidus's Uncabaret and the Diamond Club on Hollywood, where Laura Milligan hosted her tantrum shows. He and Gary took their place at a table near the stage and escaped for an evening in the routines of David Cross and Bob Odenkirk and Jack Black, aspiring comics testing their routines and honing their timing. Maynard listened to the satire and send-ups of Craig Astin and Brian Posen and began to imagine himself on the tantrum stage. If ever there were time between Tool tours, he might just give it a try. "I saw unlimited potential in him," Zappa would recall. "Maynard is a batch of raw materials. It's like those reality shows where they tell you to make clothing out of things you find at a recycling center, or give you a bunch of ingredients and say, 'Make a meal out of gummy bears and mustard.' It's like he had too many talents." At closing time, he might dart off to a romantic liaison, to his room to finish a new song, or begin a new drawing, or to the airport to make the flight to Honolulu and the next night's performance there. "It felt like he was running from something," Zappa would remember. But his was not a race against an opponent. He was determined to stay ahead of the thing that pursued him, the echo of dismissal and underestimation, as if the mediocrity he must outdistance were his own.